Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Tone Arrows podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
We have a new producer. Brian is back. He did the first 10 with us, and we're delighted to have him back. How are you, Brian?
Good, no complaints.
Yeah, great to have you back. Lads, before we get into the podcast, just to remind you that you can get some exclusive content over on Patreon if you want to help us out in any way. Any contribution is very welcome. And if you could like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel, it costs you nothing, but it would mean an awful lot to us.
So our next guest is Glenn McCarthy, a fellow Northsider, somebody that I would have drank with and drugged with down through the years. So Glenn's going to tell us a little bit about his story in relation to mental health, addiction, recovery, and what he's doing today to help him around the recovery process.
So we picked the podcast up where Glenn and ourselves are talking about growing up in the North Side, and a special shout out to Glenn's brother Paul, who's actually the producer on the night. So enjoy the podcast, and we see everybody soon.
To the rocks,
you had the Lee Valley, you know, which was a great place. Do you remember going to the Lee Valley as
a kid? Out through the nuns, out through the back way and stuff like that. Yeah. But like you'd be gone in the morning, Timmy. Yeah. You'd be gone in the morning, but you wouldn't come back until night time, until it was time to get fed, you know. Yeah. Or when the lights came on in the fucking street, you know, it was time to go in home, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Do you remember?
Sorry, James, go ahead.
Do you remember OD's shop?
By the captain to Captain Tree.
And there used to be little barbers up there as well. Remember there used to be little barbers in the back?
That's right, yeah. You get the first flashbacks, yeah. And Hogan's Alley and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the polio school used to be called the Scope Foundation.
Yeah, that's still there, I know.
There used to be a lot of drinking done in that lane, Hogan's Lane.
Yeah, you used to.
Remember the Hogan's old house with the big gates
You dare knock up that way, like, you know, how much you're in trouble. Yeah.
Unless you knew where you were going, like, that was the main area for people that were drinking back then, like. It was because we had so many different places to go drinking, and drink was the big thing back then, and the hash, you know, and people just socialised that way. It was great crack, you know, because there was nothing bad about it. People had a few drinks, they off went off home, went to work the next morning, but things then changed later on, you know. So what was it like in school for you, Glenn, growing up? Did you enjoy school?
Again, as I say, I was in Churchfield School, and them days were good as well, because I would have been in sports. I played in the hurling and football team. I played a lot of basketball and soccer. So I was kind of, I was in my little bubble and stuff. So I ventured away from Kilcairn Close and Holly Hill. Where I started hanging around was down in Groin, the Chapel Field in Groin and stuff. And that's where my first introduction to drinking drugs really was mine. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
What age were you then, Glenn?
I suppose I was around 13. That would have been in Gary Vaux. I remember Gary Vaux and Shannon Gary, the festival and stuff like that. I drank my first bottle of Linden Village, a 2 litre in Linden Village, and I paid for it the next morning, my mum and dad.
How did that make you feel? Like, what was the what was the feeling after? What did it do for you? Because it's very important for people to understand, for somebody that goes on in their life and in addiction.
Yeah.
The first time they have a drink or a drug, it changes something within them. Yeah. What did it give you?
I would have thought I would have been very outgoing and stuff like that, you know, with the sports and stuff. But when it came to interacting with others outside of my circle and my comfort blanket, I suppose I would have felt a bit inferior and stuff, you know. Mm. And all that stuff is only coming to me in the last couple of years, you know, the more I share about it and stuff. But I may have to lose my train at all.
Yeah, that's fine. Keep going. I do it all the time.
It's a social lubricant, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh,
like, and when you're a teenager as well, they're very awkward years.
Yeah.
And you're around a lot of people, especially if there's no people and there's girls, it's awkward.
Yeah.
There's nothing like a battle in the village to help you fit in.
But it helped me. I just felt I fitted in or something like that, you know what I mean? And I had a bit more of a voice or something like that, you know?
It was that one thing that you were missing.
Yeah.
And when it came then, it was like, oh no.
Yeah.
I can actually talk to a girl because I was very shy as well. Yeah, I couldn't even look at a girl or talk to a girl when I was young until the drink.
I just fell in love. Like I would have been very good at school and sports and stuff, but then when drinking stuff, I just fell in love with it. I just fell in love with that scene and everything that came around with it as well, do you know? But it definitely brought me out of myself more, if we could say that.
Did it cause trouble for you at home?
It did, very early on. I never really socially drank, to be honest.
It was always kind of madness.
My dad is in the fellowship. He wouldn't mind me saying that a long time, you know. And I remember early teens, he fucking shaking me, like saying, like, you know, you're not an alcoholic, you know. Like, I'd go home.
Is he in the fellowship, like, since you were a kid?
Yeah, he's in the fellowship nearly 40 years, no? 40 years this year. He'd be in the fellowship, yeah. So thank God for the fellowship in our house, you know.
He had a good grasp of the damage that alcohol can do to people.
Yeah, and very early on, I kind of just went out and I drank and I found it very hard to come home and stuff like that, you know. Yeah. I didn't want the party to stop and stuff like that, you know. And especially the party in my head and stuff. But then I suffered fierce as well, fierce early on as well, you know, the come downs and stuff.
Would you have been somebody that was kind of, from a young age, that would have been introverted and always thought about everything, or were you more outgoing or a bit of both?
Again, hindsight is a beautiful thing and stuff like that, you know. When I was back then, like, I thought I was grand, you know, but like I felt I had to blend in and fit in and stuff, you know, so I wasn't really myself back then. I'm only knowing this now. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, you know, and that's where the drink and all that kind of stuff came in, just to keep up with the Joneses, I suppose, you know, as the saying goes and stuff like that. But like, with the minute I took a drink, I found addiction, or addiction found me very, very fast.
And you know what's the great thing? Like, it's, I don't know, is it called great or whatever, but what I noticed was when you do have a drink, and if you don't fit into a certain group before the drink and you feel like you don't, when you have a drink and you like it, you will find a group that you'll fit into fairly fast.
Yeah, because it's funny you said that as well, because like, I would have been involved in the sports and stuff, like, so some of the lads would have been drinking way before, like, before me and stuff like that. So it was going to game a catch up or something.
Yeah.
Do you know? But like, as you say, like, I played basketball at high north. I was on the Munster team, we tried for the Irish team and all that kind of stuff. And do you know, I kind of wasn't picked in for the Irish team and I thought I should have been. And then, do you know, I kind of got sick of the basketball and then the drink came in. There was no bleeding in period. I just drank and then I just got, like, I just wanted to drink all the time. And then the hash came and then the ease and all that kind of stuff. And
so when you started drinking at the age of 13, what year is that? What year were you born?
I was 77. So around the 90s, I'd say.
So when you're coming into your
89, I could have been earlier. No,
when you're coming into your mid-teens now, the ecstasy is becoming a big thing in Cork.
Huge.
What was it like?
Jeez, I dove straight into it, man. My first ecstasy was a half a pearl. The biscuits were around.
Jeez, just before that was well before my time. I never ordered pearls.
I used to write letters for people inside of my school. You know, like, I used to have good handwriting, so I'd be everyone's mum and dad. I'd be writing different letters, but I'd be getting 50 pence for a letter or something like that, and I'd be saving up for Friday for 12.50 to get a half an ecstasy tablet. But like, that
escalated.
And then the sports kind of took a backseat as well. You know, I was involved. I can remember some of the lads in Finston's coming over after the house and trying to get me back and all that. But as I say, I went from being very good in school and stuff like that to being very good at staying out. You know, I thought I made it then, like, in Henry's came along and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but I fell in love with the XCC.
I always explain this, and the reason it's just came up recently there. I read this thing. It was about MDMA and how MDMA helps people who are with their mental health. And there's tests being done over in America at the moment, and MDMA is starting to help the war veterans and stuff with PTSD. And it made so much sense to me, because when I was able to go back into my own life, when I was really suffering my head as a young lad, you know, in my teens, and ecstasy came into my life, it was like all this stuff just stopped. And it was like, I felt love. Mm. I loved life. It was like, this is fucking great. You know, what was it like that for you?
Oh, 150 million%. Yeah. 100. And they do say it's the love drug. Yeah. It sure is. Like, you know, you'd end up back at parties with people there. Like, you know, you wouldn't be talking to them one time. Next, all of a sudden, everyone, I often hear people say, like, but it's so true. But then you kind of snap over to the next day and say, geez, how did I end up here and all that kind of stuff. But I used to live from one end of the week to the other, especially at the start. From going out on a Friday night into the Man Disco or whatever, like, just taking that ecstasy tablet around the Chapel Field and stuff, coming up and everyone. And then I couldn't wait until next week. My whole week was consumed.
Yeah.
Like, school took a back seat. You know, I did well in my junior cert. But between my junior cert and my leaving, like, I just that took up everything was about going out and just, you know, getting out on the party scene and stuff like that. And oh, I was trying to hang around with the older people and kind of going away from the lads I played sport with.
That's a great point that you just made there in relation to how addiction works, because right, you took the ecstasy tablet on a Friday night, but you were thinking about the next Friday night. It preoccupies your whole thinking. You can't get nothing else done.
Live for the weekend.
You know?
Yeah. 100%.
And all you're thinking then is about that. It's about the planning and how you're going to get this for it and that. It's amazing how it just takes complete control of everything, isn't it?
Yeah. And you made a good point about the war veterans with the MDMA, but I think we should probably say as well that the war veterans, they microdose small, very tiny amounts of it. They're not sitting down with a bag of Mitsubishi junkies listening to Sculptor thinking this is grand, isn't it? It's like, and they use ketamine and they use all sorts of psychedelics. They microdose to kind of rewire the brain into being more calmer and help them process through some of the events that have happened. So there is a lot of benefits to it.
There is, yeah.
And we did feel a lot of the benefits, but there was a lot of consequences then as well. But
do you know what actually happened in relation to that? Back in the 60s, 70s, I'm not sure the actual dates, when acid came out and the wars were going on in America with Vietnam. I don't know the timelines now, but what happened was they started, the government in America started to blame all the protests and stuff on acid and psychedelics, you know, because there was a lot of tests being done at that time in America and psilocybin and the microdose and how it was helping people within the hospitals over there. And then because of what was happening, the protests, they banned it. They stopped all these, all the research automatically because of that, and they'd done away with it. But in recent times, in the last few years, 10, 20 years, I don't know, it's been brought back in and they're really seeing, as you said, it's microdose and it's not about going away and getting stoned, because that's not right. You know what I mean? That doesn't help, because that just becomes a problem. It's about doing it at the right level when you're working with somebody that's facilitating, usually a doctor.
The American government, what they wanted to do, they were using LSD. They thought that there was this mad psychedelic drug, LSD, that was after being invented in Germany. And the American government thought they could use that to kind of control people's minds. But the problem was, it did the exact opposite.
Yeah.
It opened people's minds. And then people start protesting against the Vietnam War and poverty and racism and all this stuff. So then they quickly outlawed it.
It backfired.
In a big way. But I remember taking acid, four trips with one of the boys. I remember after about 4 or 5 hours thinking, like, you know, this is a bit heavy, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you don't wake up the next morning and think, I can't wait till next Friday. No. It's different with
you. I had bad experience on acid and mushrooms and stuff like that as well. Do you know, I did the thought of even going back into it. Like, I never had a good one anyway. I know some people did, like, but it wasn't for me. But some of the ecstasy were laced with fucking with acid as well. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
When did it,
plenty of them.
Do you know, at that age, when you started taking drugs, Glenn, did people around you starting to notice that there might have been an issue there, or did you start noticing yourself that it could have been an issue there?
Again, the lads that I was with and stuff like that, they had a few cans and stuff down in the Chapel Field, but I always went to the extreme, Timmy, James. I always went to the extreme. Like, there was no in between with me. I'm either very good or, you know, and still to this day, I can be that way. It is either, you know, one day or the other. Once I started, I just couldn't stop. Like, and it was noticed. It was definitely noticed, and it was said to me a couple of times as well. You know, from very early on, I could have been ready for the rooms and stuff. You know, you know, I always said, you know, my brother was in the rooms well before us and stuff, and my dad, and I'd always joke, like, you're not getting me to them tea and biscuits meetings. You know, growing up, I had a load of men. I thought my dad, they were all uncles and stuff. We'd load of friends, but my dad got sober early, and there was always friends of his calling, but they were all going to meetings. That's how they got around that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, we'd be down in the Chapel Field, up in the steps and stuff, smoking or drinking midweek, and all that kind of stuff. My dad and all his friends be going around the back and going to the meeting.
I know,
you know. And years later, then I was going around with my dad and them going into the meeting as well. You know?
But you know what, that them early days, like, and I have to kind of really say this as well, I actually enjoyed my life back then. It was good, and I enjoyed everything about it, you know. But it does kind of, there does become a point where the enjoyment is gone, and it's just about the need to have to get stoned on a daily basis.
I think your life back then, it's not that you enjoy the life. The life is shit, but the ease give you a little bit of a reprieve once or twice in the week.
And the company.
But you said once or twice in the week, like for the couple of hours or for the night or for three or four nights, you know the way. But like even towards the end of that, but it's the, I suffered very, very early on with the come downs and stuff because I didn't socially drink. I never did. I just went straight into it. And the bedroom scene, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. But then again, just for that, even if, you know, even to take a liner, for that 2 or 3 seconds, but or for that fucking first couple of hours, I would just do it like the bright lights and stuff, and pain has no memory kind of thing. Yeah. And it's insanity.
Explain the bedroom scene.
The bedroom scene to me is, it's the horror show. I wrote a lot about it actually, but it's just explained for myself, but my mum would have to come up to check, was I breathing? Mm. Or I'd be getting sick in my sleep. Or they'd come up and just give me a couple of relaxers and it's just a bit of soup and stuff like that. Yeah. And like, as much as I love taking the ecstasy and all that, like it just became a problem because I started owe too much money and stuff, and then I had to do other stuff to finance it, like, and don't hide your own supply. And then I'd come home with the tail team legs missing for a week and stuff, you know.
You were young then, Glenn, were you?
I was pretty young. Like, I got to ring a cab, like, in the Temple Lake we were in, and I'd ring home by mistake, you know. Yeah, and my dad said, will you ever come home? Your mum will burn down the house with all the candles,
But you don't get it at that. You don't understand what we're doing.
Straight, like, I thought I wasn't harming no one else, but like, with the worry I put on my parents and my family, I was sick. Yeah. But I'd come home and I'd go straight up the stairs and I'd be there for a couple of days. Do you know when you get so sore from lying down?
Yeah.
Do you know, like, I'd have to get up and go downstairs and
the dirty feelings, you're probably after a wash, but you feel like you're dirty
and
still.
And then it could be Wednesday, Thursday, and then the thought of it again, and then you're just plotting and scheming, how am I going to get out of this one and get money for him? And then Friday, like, what was that all about? Like, and you're back at it again. Do you know, there was one time when I came home. Well, I didn't know I came home. I was out for, it was over Christmas time. I was out for a good few days or a week. I'm not sure. But I woke up in the place. Anyway, it was a box room and stuff like that. But I didn't know where I was. And I opened the door. And it was my landing. I was in my own house at home. My mum and dad downstairs. But when I was away, they did up the bedroom and painted it and stuff. And I got new rooms. And, you know, so like, so that's where I used to be, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I hadn't a clue I was home, but I didn't know.
How were you coping? Like, what were the come downs then? Like, do you know, like, you obviously finished school and you had to go ahead then and work.
Yeah.
You know, and what was your line of work then?
Yeah, I'm a decorator by trade. When I came out of school, my mum put, I did leave and sort, and I did okay and leaving stuff, but that time was the Henry's time, you know, and
tough times,
I loved everything about it. I thought I had a maid that time, but I was a painting decorator, and so my mum brought me straight up to into Foss. So there was an electrician one. I wanted to be an electrician, I think, at the start, and then there was a painter and decorator. So Michael Davis, he actually lives up Morville Long, where my brother lives. Today, and I went up, and she went away and got a suit off my Uncle Mark. This is for an interview for a painting job, and only put on a suit. You was looking at me coming in, you know, but I got the job straight away anyway. And I'm painting since I'm painting decorator by trade, but you know, sure, in the latter, like, I worked for my father, then my dad was a subcontractor with that kind of stuff, and everyone that worked for us was kind of the same ilk as me. You know, we get a subby off my dad on a Monday, he mightn't see us until he mightn't see us until Friday. And we'd be going around the place with our overalls on and all that, or side tracks every night with the overalls on. And
but
I still functioned for a good bit, Tim, but like it was horrendous, really. You know, especially the head stuff. Do you know, like, putting yourself through that torture and stuff, and the only thing that would take it away is another drink and stuff like that. You know what I mean? But you're only prolonging it every time. Like,
I remember being a first year apprentice painter, you know, like yourself, getting me check for me €250 on the Friday. Yeah. And fucking hell, you wouldn't even go home.
Yeah.
We wake up somewhere on the Monday morning, the paint is still on the fingers from the Friday, and then you're missing work, or sometimes arriving into work with the eyes like that, trying to fucking sand an ugly skirting board or something. Oh, it's horrible.
I grew up around the corner from yourselves, like in Paul, and there was an area where all the lads used to drink around the corner of the tarmac.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of people know who are listening to that.
Yeah,
this will know the tarmac. There's houses in the tarmac now these days.
Yeah.
But like, you could go over to that place at any hour of any day of the week, like, and you probably would find somebody there, you know, coming back from somewhere or some party, like, and they'd be getting another party going. Yeah. They were mad.
There was no
times,
difference
right?
in day. There was no Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday kind of thing, you know. But
it was a mad place. Like, I was actually afraid of that place because I was younger. Like, I was afraid I'd go up the road the other way because you wouldn't know who's after being drinking or stoned over there. I'm not going that way. I know they'll start mocking me or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so I was shy as a kid. Yeah. I was shy. But later on in years, like when I started getting a bit older, I started, you know, it was definitely one of the places to go to as a teenager. You know, there was a good crack over there. There was a great buzz, the atmosphere. Everybody was there, and everybody really enjoyed themselves. You know, didn't they? And
how did your life develop as you went into your 20s and maturing a bit?
I don't know about maturing, but I suppose like my bar would have been the Temple Acre, I suppose probably might have spoke about it, but you would have to buzz in and buzz out of the bar, you know. And I used to be in there constantly 24/7. Like I used to walk, obviously I used to walk, like it's not, you know, but sometimes I had to finance my drink other ways and stuff, but that was a disaster anyway as well, you know, it was just to get more and more.
But like, you were still kind of able to hold a job.
I was, but plus as well, I worked for my dad and stuff, and you know, like I was able to get along with that. And but like the stuff we put him through, like I don't know, like and everyone that was with us, like drank in the Temple Acre as well, you know, they were all the same as me. All of us were the exact same, you know. But like we got by, and I did loads of foxes and stuff. I'd be doing foxes just to get extra. I used to make a fortune. I used to do foxes just to fucking pay for what I did the weekend before and all that kind of stuff. And it was just a snowball, and it was just like that all the time. And sometimes then it came to a stage where I just couldn't work. You know what I mean? I just wasn't able, and I'd finance my drink through any means necessary, you know, that kind of way.
Yeah. Like, was it more alcohol then after a while, or did cocaine come into your life?
No, cocaine was huge for me. And even talking about it now, you know, and psychosis came into my life, and, you know, like, and just having more vodka just to calm that. And then eventually then I started drinking on my own. I even came away from the Temple Acre and all the lads and stuff, and I was in and out of recovery and treatment centres at this stage and institutions and all with the head stuff, you know, because of my consumption. And, but I couldn't stop then, like, it's mad. Like, I knew, like, it just taking that line and I'd be paranoid straight away. Yeah. Like, I mean, really paranoid.
We've had a good few people contact us over the years. They've either experienced psychosis or their loved one has. Will you explain to us what it is, what it feels like, and just maybe just explain it?
Yeah, I was in a period in my life, I was in it and I didn't know. I was actually told by St. Michael's that I was in full-blown psychosis, you know, so I was functioning. I was going to work, I was collecting underwear. I was in work thinking day, you know, there was something happened and it snowballed. Like the light used to come out of my van, and I used to be coming home with a friend of mine, like, and I used to think they used to have a boat, they know I'm coming home. And then I'd be at home, like, you know, my kids were young enough this time. And like, not that I don't like saying this stuff, but it's my story and stuff. Like I used to be thinking there was people in the house and there was a secret door in the wardrobe and all that kind of stuff, and people were coming in, but I could see, physically
extreme,
see them.
Extreme paranoia.
I was afraid to breathe, do you know, I thought my heart was making too much noise, did mate, you know?
Yeah.
All that stuff, and that followed me, my shadow, I was scared of my shadow, literally, do you know, and it, like even in the end, I thought my family were in on it and everything, conspiracies and going into treatment centres, if my book was moved, I think that, you know, and someone from the north side or something. Like I was in Table Lodge three times in 1 year. I went out of it twice over paranoia. Mm. You know, and I was going from there to the nuns and all that kind of stuff. And I was
Table Lodge is a treatment centre based in Cork.
And I was living with that for a year and a half, and like non-stop. But I can still kind of go into it today with a thought or a sound or a noise without a drink or a drug.
Really?
But I can handle it better, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But sometimes it just takes a life.
Do you think you have lasting consequences so mentally through the drug use, but you've handled on it?
100%. Yeah.
Do you know the psychosis? Just to go back onto that, because a lot of that stuff was in part of my story as well. A lot of it, you know, I can relate to a lot of the stuff you were talking about. But is the psychosis something that was happening while you were off the drugs as well, or was it something that was happening while you were flat out?
No. Like in the end, like I know for a fact, if I took a line, right, or even looked at it, I'm in it straight away, and everything makes sense. Then there's a reason. Like after, you know, a while, like he'd be involved in stuff in my head. He'd be talking about something or the guy or like everything.
Like the Truman Show. It's obviously the Truman Show with Jim Carrey.
And it's all so real, like, but everything, I could justify everything. Yeah. Like, it was my living, breathing reality. Yeah.
It was the reality. There was no kind of, there was no thought behind it saying, oh, I'm fucking taken there, I'm thinking like this. It was just, that was everything.
I would have been in St. Michael's and not on the stuff, and I thought there was people in there, and then I was in there, and like the vodka would take it away, you know, all that kind of stuff. But like, and then I go down to the treatment set. But like, even like, it went on for a long time, even without it, you know. And then I was on with 22 tablets a day prescribed by the doctors, like, you know, like lyrical, everything, antipsychotics, the whole lot. But then I was taking stuff on top of that then, and I knew what was doing to me, but I couldn't stop taking it. And then, like, the lies, not even lies, like, it just consumed me. It just totally and utterly consumed me. And I would say I would be scared from it and stuff like that. But I can just see it for what it is when it comes, and then it goes as fast. But sometimes it can take over. Mm. But I kind of tend to speak about it a bit more often than not, you know.
Yeah, because it's a big thing that affects a lot of people.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
People don't understand it, and they mightn't be, you know, you don't get anybody talking about it in the media either. So it's good for you to talk about it. Have you ever been, when you're in your psychosis, admitted to psychiatric hospitals? Did you ever do like overnights in St. Michael's and stuff like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, but I was kind of a regular in there then as well, you know. And I tried to take my own life a couple of times because I couldn't handle any of this stuff, you know. A lot of them were cries for help. A lot of it was drama, big ball of drama. But in the end, when I was caught up in this, like I didn't know what was right or what was wrong, what was real, what was not. And I was still trying to function.
Yeah.
The insanity of that, and awake all night, not sleeping for weeks and weeks and weeks, and even that blow stuff, I was mad for all that kind of stuff. And I was a guinea pig for that. I used to test that stuff.
And that was the worst thing that you could take for it as well.
Yeah.
And you know, when you hear about people back in the day, you'd hear horror stories of people that they take a drug, a trip, and they don't come out of it. That's kind of the psychosis side of it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Some people, they end up in, you know, just psychiatric cases for longer term.
That you said that, like, I would have been in hospital and, like, I would have been pointed out, like, right here now you have psychosis. Like, this fella had drinking drug fueled psychosis and he never came out, and this fella have it. Like, he, you know, he's born this way or whatever, and you're on a thin line and you're still your borderline, and you're still coming in and out of it, you know what I mean, and you're still coming into us. That's the way it was pointed out to me.
Scary, isn't
like
it?
Is it that's total utter insanity.
Yeah.
But then, like, what I knew was doing it, I still couldn't stop it, like, even just for that first minute or two. And, like, but in between all of it, even when I hadn't got it, then it was my reality. Like, I would be working in people's houses and I'd hear a noise. I'd be upstairs painting the bedroom and I wouldn't come down. I thought they were in the attic day, like, but it was all growing legs. I don't believe something happened, but it just grew legs. And
you said you have kids as well. What was your relationship like with your kids and your partner at this time? Must be very difficult.
Yeah, but, like, my kids were very young, you know, and even speaking about it now, and they'll probably see this and stuff, like, but, you know, they know daddy means well, and, you know, that it's about helping as well, you know, like, you know, I was that hopeless case, and I nearly very tapped out.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But I'm not. I didn't. And I think it's important as well to speak about this stuff as well, you know. But the kids and stuff, like, Rhea would have been very young, you know, and Charlie would have been a bit young as well, you know what I mean? So, like, they know I go to meetings and all that kind of stuff.
The mother of the kids at that time?
Yeah, I'm no longer ill, you know, but I'd say it was very tough, like, even for my family as well, you know, like, I have to put and hold my hand up there, like, you know, like, it was like I was living two lives and stuff like that.
Can you imagine now, like, you're a parent now. You can put yourself in your dad's position. What it must have been like to see not just one of his sons either.
Like, you know, my friends following me around the city in the county, like, you know, just behind me back, like, in getting arrested on Shandon Street after, you know, going into there and drinking vodka at the counter, or coming over across the road into a van, and I had one bottle for blood and one for just vodka. If I, you know, that's where I went, and I drank that back then. If it was, you know, that's where I ended
that
up.
Is
like,
where, that is
taken on to St. Michael's from Shandon Street then, or.
That's where it brings you, so
like, talking about that, not really. But it's
important
that's
to talk about, because that's where it brings you.
Yeah.
You know, that's where addiction brings you. It brings you to, like, it's great that you're speaking very openly about this stuff and you're very honest.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important because people need to understand how bad it can be.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very easy. Like, like the loneliness.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The loneliness, like what I'm just sitting here and taking your story in, because I've often, like, we're good friends and I've often spoke to you about your story, and we sat down and, you know, but you're going into a lot more detail today, you know, but it's that lonely place, especially when the psychosis is there as well, and you can't trust no one, you can't ring nobody, and it's just lonely. And then when people don't answer your phone to you, then when you need more drugs or money or whatever, it's like, it's like threefold in. You know, it's a really tough place to be in.
And cocaine is such a big issue in Ireland at the moment. And people are out there and they're working away, you know, and they're having their lines on the weekends or whatever, and they think it's grand. But there's a fine line. And you might be susceptible to this thing, and you might never know about it until you're in fucking, you have an episode, you know?
Yeah.
And it might be too late. So it's just people have to be aware of that too.
Yeah.
It's not a safe drug like people might think it is.
Do you know cocaine? Right, and I'll be brief in this. Cocaine, I used to go around the place and I was involved in drugs as well, and I took a lot of cocaine. It was the main drug of choice for me. And I used to justify it because I looked at it as being a sociable drug, and it was sociable. It wasn't a dirty drug, let's say. Like heroin was looked upon as in something that was bad, you know. But I'll tell you, from my own cocaine use, it brought me to a place that I couldn't imagine. I could imagine myself being inside in a hole just very, very easily. I was in a broken man, completely paranoid, you know. People are out there and they think, I'll only do it on the weekends. And that's fine. That's fine. It might be grand for a few weekends. It might be grand for a while. But what happens is, right, this is what happens. You'll go through a difficult part in your life. Something might happen. There might be somebody die. You might have a breakup in a relationship. The first thing you're going to turn to heal that pain, so you can soothe that little bit of pain that you've internally, is that drug. And what happens then from that is, you'll start becoming very dependent on it. And you'll go from the weekends to the Wednesday, the Thursday, Friday, and you'll get caught up in it, and you'll get caught up in the drug then, and lives are tumbled upside down after it then. And that is the reality of cocaine and other drugs, you know, and that's what happens.
When I was working in drug and alcohol services there for a couple of years, the main thing that people would come to us with was alcohol. That's a given in most treatment areas. But you know what the number one drug was? Cannabis. People were just demented from it because, you know, if you're susceptible to a mental health issue or a mental illness, you might have a gene or something that it might have never been triggered if you never smoked it. But people had, and they were going into psychosis because of the cannabis, causing them fierce issues in their life.
I used to smoke when I was younger, right? Cannabis and stuff like that. But like, I would literally take anything. I've never went down the other road. And if I was there, I probably would have. But what I'm trying to say is, I used to get very paranoid over that at the very start as well. Over just hash on its own. So I kind of never went there. Timmy was saying there, like, as much as I just spoke about cocaine and what it did for me, you know, and I was a heavy drinker as well. But even still today, I could still think about that. And you know, you brought up a point there, and it just resonated. Like the last couple of years, if I had a slip and stuff like that, you know, I know what was going to happen if I took it. But you know, for that first 2-3 seconds of like that comfort of taking something that I know it's going to fucking make me paranoid for the next week.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even the night. Like, it just really fucking sends me, and I still go in and take it. Like,
it's
that draw for that soothing, you said it.
It's the euphoric feeling that you get from them.
That's it.
Then the head is gone.
It comes at me then straight away, the paranoia. Like, that's insane. And then I used to drink vodka. That was my drink, like, and lots of it. Like, in the end, when I was on my own, I used to be going around the place on my own for years. Like, I'd be in and out of people's lives and I'd be grand, but I was functioning myself that way. But I would have to drink that to sort out the psychosis and the paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I'd end up with, I was off to drinking, I'd be taking coke on his own for fucking months on and off, living, you know, even when people thought I wasn't taking it, like, and just the energy it took just to function and just to do stuff was absolutely mad. Crazy.
It's mad.
How did it come to a head for you?
It came to a head a couple of times, I suppose. I would have ended up in hospital and stuff, and my insides were ruined from all the drink I used to be taking, so I used to be passing blood a lot. Do you know, I'd end up owing loads of money or something, and then I'd end up in hospital, and then I'd be off to a treatment centre. Treatment centres were a big part of my life, and do you know, and then I'd go away, and I'd go away and stuff, and I get well, and I'd get well, and I come back into the rooms of A and stuff like that.
How long would you get out of it?
The most I got without drinking was nearly 5 years, but for the last year and a half of that, I was going to meetings, but I was starting dabbling with the coke again. Do you know, and all the secrecy of that and all that kind of stuff, and then eventually the head would snap and I couldn't handle it, and I just downed something, and then it's just fucking a big ball of drama.
It might be good learning there now for people, and Paul gave us great learning the last time he was here, because he was multiple years as well and went back out there. What was the thought process before you started to pick up? Like, were you starting to question the rooms, or were you starting to question, am I an addict? Yeah. Or
my big thing, and I always say it in the rooms, and is like, I'd fade away. I'd never stop going to meetings or anything. My life gets well again. I'm going to the gym. Work is good. The kids, the family is good. There's no thing. But like, I'd step away from what we will. Do you know, when I was in Fellowship House, we used to go down to the Sacred Heart to a meeting, and I heard a woman saying that she faded away, and I said, that's me. That's me. So I wouldn't stop. I'd fade away. And like, there wouldn't even be a thought. Like, you know, the slip before the slip, they say.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't. But I suppose sometimes if I'm left on my own, right? Like, if I know, at the time the kid's mother was going out and stuff like that, because I used to go, because I used to drink no more. Yeah. Then I wasn't in the meetings. I wasn't around people as much speaking about the stuff. But I didn't know that then. Like, then it thought, I'd get away with that, but I'd fester on that for a week or two, and then eventually, before you know it, but then trying to get it, because everyone who I was offering, no one was allowed to give it to me, kind of thing. Yeah. It was mad, like the things I used to have to do to get it, but I used to always be able to get it. And then for weeks and weeks and weeks, I'm taking it, no one knows. Next, all of a sudden, there's vodka in my hand, but it's over because I can't handle it no more. And
you said something there, and I think it's important to bring back to where you said something about the slip before the slip. The slip before the slip. Do you want to explain what that is? And I'll just give a brief description of it. The slip before the slip is the thinking, the mind, the planning of maybe going away to use something or the way I can get drunk and not talking to anybody else about it. Mm. And you're festering in your head and you're planning, you're running with the film of it in your head, and you're actually slipping. You're nearly there.
If we had no way of stepping back from the meeting.
Yes. And you're keeping it to yourself because deep down you're getting excited
it. You actually know it's coming. Like, yeah. You know it's coming. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it'd be grand. But even in the end, because I'm in old rooms a good few a long time. It was in 2006, you know. So like, I would have got good stints of recovery and stuff, and did service and all that. But like, my one was I would just fade away. I would fade away, and then I wouldn't drink first. I would probably take the substance first. Usually people drink and then take the other thing, you know. But then I couldn't handle that. But it was all secrecy and stuff like that, you know. And I just couldn't handle it. But my slip would, I wouldn't be going to meetings and I wouldn't be around and stuff, but I'd get that fucking urge or something. Yeah. Like, and people are out and enjoying themselves and I'm not. And it's the poor me's then would come in and I justify stuff and no one will know.
Would you tell somebody to do if they're feeling like that before they actually relapse? What would you tell someone to do? Like, would you tell them to break the silence this time around?
This time around, because like, I had a bad slip last year, actually, just after getting married, to be honest. Yeah. You know, and it was pretty bad. Like, I just pick up the phone. Or if I'm talking to someone, or if I go to Blarney meeting stuff, like in the meeting, like, whereas before I wouldn't say it. I'm thinking about taking a drink. I wouldn't, because you know what? I wouldn't want to say it because I rat on myself out just in case I do want to do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's all
the
that. Like,
horror of it.
Yeah. You're in a meeting, but you're not really in the meeting anymore. You know what I mean?
You're losing the honesty.
And fuck it, you know, fuck it.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter how long you're off it, because we were away last week, and I was walking past an off license on the street and I was on my own, and the head came in and said, there was nothing wrong with me. Jesus, do you know what? No. Nobody'd know if you went in there and got an old bottle and you'd be running and keep it yourself and going away. And I was like, where is this coming from?
We were in Porto with a lot of civil servants, and we did a conference, an international prison conference thing. And afterwards, all the pressure was over. It went really well. We went out, we had a lovely steak. Me and Timmy had a big fucking tomahawk steak between us. Afterwards, then people were there drinking cocktails. And me and Timmy were there on mocktails, you know. Sex on the beach with no alcohol and fucking dry humping on the beach, I was calling it. But there's a party thinking, like, wouldn't it be all right in a small drop of fucking vodka and that, you know, loosen up a small but have a sink.
And that's how it's happened for me, man, that kind of stuff, you know, and just trying to get a snakey drinking even when you were in company or something like that. Like, and it's just.
But you have to watch that thinking. The point really here is that
it
thinking.
Goes, like,
there's nothing wrong with thinking about it, you know. I know, because it does come into my head because I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict.
It is about catching it straight away, isn't it?
And then you can just throw it up
and tell somebody about it.
But I'd be like that with my thinking, you know, my thinking. Like, I can just catch it, I can see it for what it is, I can see it coming more often than not. Sometimes I don't and it just runs away at me and just people would just know, you know. I'd be, you know. But
so what's different this time around for Glenn? In recovery. What have you learned from the last time?
What have I learned? And this is only recent.
About you, like?
Yeah, it never works anywhere. Yeah. It never works. There's always drama. I'm very lucky to be here.
Yeah.
Every time, like, that's where it goes. No, like, I don't get an hour, a couple of hours out of it in the morning. I want to end it all. It's just, and my head can't take it and stuff. Do you know, but I know there's more to life as well, you know. Do you know, to that, the last couple of years, you know, I kind of fell in love with a bit of writing and stuff. And it's kind of, I don't know, you obviously, it's my happy place and stuff. But when I tend to write, like, I get the feeling like it's all the stuff, all the trauma, all the stuff that I went through in my life is able to come out better. Do you know what I mean? And it just goes onto the page. And like, I've heard for years and years and years in treatment centres and other places I was in that I should take up creative writing. And I fucking used to take offence to it, thinking that they thought I was dramatising my story. No, again, in hindsight, like, it makes sense now, because it was just the way I was explaining my story and stuff. But I was getting very bad over it. Like, this is my fucking story. Because anytime I read something, you know, a bit of work you get done, and where I look up and everyone is looking at me like, and a couple of counsellors often say that to me, you know. So now these days, that's what I do. I do a bit of writing and a bit of meditation and stuff like that. And I meditate every morning. Yeah. Some mornings, some for 10 minutes, others for. And
what does that do for you? What does the meditation and the writing do for your head?
It just realizes how fucking busy my head can be as well. Do you know, you'd be able to sit with that uncomfortableness and stuff at the start, and I'd be persistent, and I'd be persistent enough, you know, to say in the fellowship, like, keep coming back. Yeah. And that's the one thing, thank God, up till today, that I keep doing. You know, and you know, life is for living, like, you know, and I'm really enjoying my life today, you know.
You look very fit.
Yeah, you look very fit.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of training these days. I was always into fitness and training and stuff like that, you know. And that's what used to happen in the rooms as well. I get fit in the gym and the work and all that, and then I'd fade away, you know. But you know, this time, tis all or nothing. I'm training for an Ironman. I joined the Cork Tri Club there, a triathlon club, the last couple of months. And over the last year, I'm training away myself. And I kind of put it out there that I was doing one, you know. So I was training away myself, and now I'm in the Cork Tri Club, and I had my first race there over the weekend down in Kerry, the duathlon, and I'm doing the Yall one, and I signed up for the Barcelona one. It's all or nothing.
Just for anybody.
There's no in between. Like,
just channeling the addiction into something that's more healthier.
And they say when I was out on the bike, you know, I kind of meet new people every week. There's around 300 people in the club, like, and they say you're either born into this, your family and stuff, or it's you're a GA fella that's after retiring, or someone in sport, and you're filing a traveling, or else there's the addiction, and they just hand up straight away. Like, I'm the addiction fella anyway. Do you know
for
I mean?
Anybody that doesn't know what a triathlon is, do you want to just explain what's involved in finishing a triathlon?
I know, young man.
An Ironman is just a longer triathlon. It's just a swim, a bike, and then a run.
And how long are they for?
Not just a swim, a bike, and a run.
How long are they for?
Well, the Ironman is 3.8 kilometer swim.
Right.
The bike is 180 kilometer, and then there's a marathon, 42 kilometer after that.
Just a run.
There's half Ironman, and then there's Olympic distances, and then like there's a lot of there's a lot of social side to the club as well, and people might even do them distances, you know, like there's sprints and stuff. Now, in saying that, I'm under no illusion, like I haven't done a full one yet, but I am training to get there, like, and you know, I have the head for it. I definitely have the I'm after finding something that fits me, man. I really am, you know, and I'm enjoying the journey, as tough as some days are, you know what I mean?
And it's also allowing you to eat what you want. You know, there's things you can eat what you want because you're burning off. Yeah. You're burning 5,000 or 6,000 calories there, going out on the bike or whatever.
A mini Ironman this morning in the gym, you know, just myself, like on the watt bike, and then I run off after, and then I swim in the morning with the club, like, and even I'm calling the club now. But no, I have a buzz for it, you know what I mean? I really have it, like.
Like, there's a change, like, there's a change, because I know your story, I know you well, you know, and I see what you're doing with yourself today, you know, you're writing your poems and stuff, like, the depth that's in your poem is there, like, is powerful around, like, how the head can start attacking us, and particularly if we have no understanding around our thinking, and we don't understand the actual biology of our thoughts and how they actually, where they come from, person can actually start believing what's going on in their head, but not like from watching and reading some of your poems. Do you want to explain?
Yeah, hold up the book to the camera.
Do you want to explain what the book is about?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the last Jen came downstairs. We got married last year on April the 23rd, right? And I got COVID for the second time that Christmas, right? And I used to listen to Moji and Eckhart Tolle a lot and all the stuff that my brother does. And I tried to break it down in my own words and I started putting into WhatsApp groups, right? And a lot of people said, geez, that's very good. I can understand that, you know? So it's like sometimes I write, I sit down and it's like the formless me, you know, like this presence and stuff is writing the physical me's experience. And I just get out of my own way. And sometimes, so I said, I'm going to write a book. Someone said, there's a book in you. So last January and February, the January and February before we got married of last year, I wrote a book titled My Truth and the Search for It, right? So I had it written in two months now. I've never did anything like this in my life, right, at all, right, going back to what you were saying about the creative writing, do you know? But Jen came, in the process of doing that, Jen came downstairs one day and I makes a coffee on the stovetop. So by the time she went out and brewed it, I said, I'm going to write a poem for her. And I was thinking of saying that at the wedding. And before she came back in, I had a poem written, first time ever writing a poem. Like I'm after at least writing 150 poems since this time last year, do you know?
And the poems, that's your first book. You've another book as well.
Yeah, but my truth in the search for it is kind of like I showed to a few people that know me and they said it was good and stuff like that. But like it leaves a lot of grammarly stuff. But I gave it to an editor then, and he gave me a couple of.
And that's your personal life story.
Yeah, he gave me a couple of home truths about it that he doesn't think it's ready. And I took on board criticism. You know, it was constructive criticism, and I needed to hear that. But like, so I started working with Stanley. You put me on to Stanley. You know what? He was on the podcast with G, and I listened to the podcast by, and I just totally identified him with the head stuff. So you put me on to Stanley. So I'm kind of with Stanley for the last year. He's like my mentor.
Yeah. And that book there is just how many poems are in it, Glenn?
I think there's around 55 poems.
And what's your favorite poem? No, I know there might be many favorite poems in that, but what poem really sticks out for you in that book? And it just gives you in context of where your head was back in the time. And if you would you be able to read it out for us?
I would. I like there's the first title of the book, like the first section of the book is called The Slip.
Yeah.
So I wrote for, I was out back, went back out there for 6 or 7 weeks after the wedding and stuff. But I scribbled through the whole 6 and 7 weeks while I was in bedsits and running around the county and stuff. Mm. So you were all looking after, trying to find me and stuff like that and going through town. So the first section of this is the slip. So it's actually stuff that I wrote, some of it in psychosis and stuff and in bedsits.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're really the raw ones. And it's that editor said to me, he said, Stanley told me about your poems, read me one of them inside John Tyne is his name, read me one of them. So I read Torment to him and he nearly fell off the seat. He says, that's the direction you need to go.
Will you read Torment?
I will.
Please.
I will, And so there's a lot of art behind each of the poems as well.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's kind of 4 pages, but it's they're short writings, you know, you can see So this is Torment. Pressing hard to handle jealous tendencies, crippled with paranoid factitious rumours, conversations upstairs without my consent, stories growing legs, it did happen, I'm not making it up, pulse accelerates, relent, clock ticking, sweat dripping, all so real, trying in vain not to feel the pain, the invisible pain, insanity thinking, who's blinking, run and hide, it's tough bringing up a front whilst you're crumbling inside, nowhere to hide, holding my breath, heart pounding, shh, they'll hear me. What's that? Secret doorway in my wardrobe. Enemy at the gate, the passage to my room. I can never find it, but it's there, I swear. One more line, heightened the horror show, can't help myself. Scared little boy in a man's body. Who's that? Why are they always in black? Heart attack. Don't move, can't move. Breathe, Glenn, breathe. Shallow breath, they'll hear me. My heart is making too much noise. Paranoid, shh, shh, shh. Nosebleed, run. Hide, please let us subside. Crying inside, never doing it again. Oh, our past, pulse slowing, they disappear, justifying. What was that all about? Just one more line, insanity, insanity, back to insane, going off my game. Go through it again, fuck it again, addicted to self-inflicted pain, self-sabotage, torment, torment, repent. Why is that window open? Here we go again. This me, myself and I, internal dialogue, external forces plotting against me. Why do you do this to yourself? Why? Psychosis in me, yet I can't see it, always follows me. Suffering, suffering, suffering. Self-inflicted torment, drinking drug-fueled psychosis, my living, breathing reality. Dawn comes, see, need something to come down, time to put on a show. Masks on, light, last night never happened. Off to work, collect on the way, here we go again. Engine light comes on, they have a boat. Fuck. By paranoid, dressed in Glenn's clothes.
Jeez. Fucking hell. That gives you some insight as to what's going on in your head in that moment.
When he does that stuff. So there's a lot of that stuff. It's called The Slip. And it's like one of them I wrote in The Welcome 4 years on, in The Welcome in the pub, you know.
Early Morning House.
The Early Morning Pub and to hell and back. So.
But that gives you a great insight as to what you're actually, when you're in it.
Yeah.
That's like, it brings you straight to it.
Yeah, there were times during that period when I was in...
I could have never put the words onto anything like that before. The way you're able to put words...
They were written active, especially the bedroom scene and stuff like that when I was in the B&B in the Western Road. So, like, you know, like any time I looked left or right, I was getting the biggest of frights. It was the writing that was keeping me, do you know what I mean? The mirror had eyes on me and the cold bathroom floor getting sick in the sink. I scribbled. It was scribbles. It wasn't written in poem format. It was a lot of scribbles on my phone and stuff.
Which just gave you a focus, like,
you know.
For 6 weeks I did that. So there's a lot of that stuff there, and then there's other stuff then. So it's like a journey from darkness to light. With there's a load of art as well involved in it.
Do you know what stood out for me there as well? Do you know when you're in that kind of place that psychosis and you're at it for a few days and stuff, there's no music anymore.
No.
Everything has to be still because you're around the house like that trying to hear noises to see. You're peeping out the window then for hours and hours and hours. Mm. And you're just waiting for the noise.
Mm.
And it's like your own breathing then is something that's actually, you're afraid of it. Mm. And you're stopping your own breathing because you're hearing things. It's like, it's actually mad. It's just like,
you're
mad.
In one position for around an hour.
It's and mad. Just
like, never again, never again.
And then your body starts to lock.
But then you come around and then you start making noise again and then you take it. And
you're going again.
Dazzled.
Well, if somebody wanted to get a copy of the book, how would it go about it?
Yeah, so this is all, it is out for pre-order there now. So most of the stuff that we're actually doing a launch. We're doing a launch up in St. Vincent's Hall in the football club. We found out today, and it's the day of the marathon, the 4th of June. Myself and Jen are doing the half marathon. I'm doing the half marathon with her. And it's on at 5:30 up in Finson's, but it's ready for pre-order as well. And they'll put the link in into the show after the show and stuff. But anything to do with it will be coming out soon. As regard, we'll be on Hello, My Friend, PMC, Paul's thing. So it'll be coming out for that. And it's ready for pre-order now as well. And we'll be doing a big book launch as well, you know.
You know, if people want to contact you, say hello or give you a message, how can they do that?
Again, through Hello, My Friend and stuff like that. And I've no kind of Instagram.
We leave the links in the...
The links will be there. They'll be greatly appreciate it, you know.
You should do the spoken word with your poems and do them on the social media, but because a lot of people are going to be able to relate with a lot of the stuff.
I think that's the next process of it, you know. Like, as much as there's a poetry collection and some poetry book, my initial thing was to write a book and stuff, but my story is actually in there as well. Yeah. You know, there's 1,000-word introduction to each section, and it'll just bring you on a journey, you know, from my darkness into light. So there's hope as well at the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I do it, really, and it's the sole purpose, really, is like, why not write a book or a poetry book and go to the comfort zone? Why not do a podcast?
Yeah.
Why not do seminars, what Paul is doing? Yeah. Why not us, like?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You mightn't have to write a poetry book or a podcast, but it could be something else.
Find something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It could be fucking helping your neighbour across the road, but just get involved in stuff because you're not on your own. I thought I was on my own for years. As much as I didn't want for anything or so I thought. I was locked up here, by.
Mm.
I was in my own fucking cell, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With no way out.
To find your purpose, don't you?
Yeah. And a bit of focus as well. And the training has done that for me.
Yeah.
No, it might be a bit extreme for others, but I'm fucking loving it.
Do you know, when that book comes out, just get ready for a lot of mad stuff coming your way.
Yeah.
Because I tell you now, Glenn, by it.
Yeah, I'm very proud of it, man. And, you know, thanks to Stan as well for guiding me and helping all the family from all the support I have from family and friends and stuff. And there's a lot of that in there as well. I really enjoyed the journey of making it, and I won't be stopping here, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you, lads. Thank you.
A lot of learning there for people, a lot of wisdom.
Yeah.
And it's great to see you looking so well and doing so well.
Appreciate it.
And thanks to Paul for being our producer on the night.
And you know,
as well,
before we finish up, a shout out to the women in our lives as well. Yeah. That really kind of keep us going. Yeah. Like, I know your wife, Jen.
Do you know what? Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah. But yeah, just for Jen and for my kids and stuff that would be here listening. Like, you know, it's all for a good reason. And my family that I have behind me and stuff. Like.
And you have a good family, Glenn.
I'm totally blessed.
You have a good family.
And with the friends and stuff, I always say, take away our second name because there's so many of us wrong doing it. And I always, and well done on the Opera House as well.
Thank you very much.
You know, we always say, to Paul, I was doing a retreat up in the thing, and you were on the Opera House that time. I wasn't up at that time, but when you mentioned the movement, and it's actually like on the book that I wrote, that didn't come out yet. It's only a first half now, it might never come out, but I had it on chapter 16 was kind of the movement and what we were all doing as a community around the place. You know, and that's what I feel it is. And we're blessed that we have so much around us. Like,
we're blessed in Ballyhill and Knocknaheeny that there's so many people there in recovery and they're open about it. But we need more people to write books, to do what Paul is doing, retreats, and just kind of
step
be proud
over
about
comfort
it. You know?
Zone.
And show people that there's more to life, as you said it yourself earlier, there's more to life than drinking drugs.
Yeah, and it's about bringing as many people along for the journey as we can, you know. But you said it, like, without our support and our loved ones, like, we'd be lost. Like, and I'm truly blessed, like, you know, with Jen and my life and stuff. Yeah. And my kids and stuff and their mum, and we all get on grand, like, you know. So it makes life easy,
don't it?
It sure does, you know what I mean? So they're in the background, like,
Listen, thank you so much, boy, for coming in and sharing your story with us. You know, I know how difficult it can be for anybody to share their story, but I know your story on a personal level, and I know how it was. And, you know, you're actually an inspiration to a lot of people, and when people listen to this, they're going to know where you came from, and they're going to find hope from your story, because, and that's what it just is, it's hope, because you were at the bottom, you know, and you climbed yourself right up, and you're here today, you're shining, you're married, you're writing books, you're helping people, and you're bringing up your kids, you know, and you're able to bring them up, and that's the biggest thing. It'll offer me that I'm able to teach my kids a different life to the life I had. You know, teach them how to live in today's world. And that's the biggest pleasure that I have today. But if I died in the morning, I know that I lived a bit of a nice life, you know. Because when I was caught up in an addiction, I was just living to survive and just to cope with what was going on for me internally. But today I'm living, you know. And I'm so glad that I'm here today just to hear your story at the table, because it's powerful. And I mean that. And we had Tommy here a few weeks ago as well.
Yeah.
You know, and now we might have the two of you or all of you here, all of us here, Paul, the whole lot of us sitting around the table at some stage, you're talking about how we're all getting on in recovery at some stage down the line.
But isn't it amazing, even the four of us here in the room and stuff like that, from where we came from and from where we're at and stuff like that. So, but it's so true. I hope there's absolutely no such thing as a hopeless case. Yeah. Never give up. Never give up on yourself. And if there's something going on, just open your mouth, you know what I mean? Just there's always help there.
Thanks,
great,
Glenn.
Great words to finish on. Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Glenn.
See everybody next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.